another look at American foreign policy that needs a lot of examination these days, these months, these years. My guest is a man who's been involved in making foreign policy and carrying it through in various presidential administrations, Elliot Abrams, who was, of course, active in the Reagan administration as a foreign policy consultant, and then in the George W. Bush administration, served as National Security Deputy National Security Advisor and Deputy Assistant directly to the President, a distinguished contributor to the literature in foreign policy issues as one of the... Do they count you as a senior editor or contributing editor at Commentary?
No, just plain old contributor.
Good. And as a contributor, we have a fascinating article, which I want to depend upon heavily in our conversation, published just now in September in Commentary, titled The Citizen of the World Presidency. It is an analysis of the works and ways of the current President of the United States as regards American foreign policy. Let me read you, if I may, Elliot, just to get this started, one particular comment by Barack Obama about his foreign policy. He said, "I would put our legislative and foreign policy accomplishments in our first 2 years against any president, with the possible exceptions of Johnson, FDR, and Lincoln, just in terms of what we've gotten done in modern history. But, you know, when it comes to the economy, we've got a lot more work to do, and we're going to keep on doing it." There you have it. Now, that's a judgment of his first 2 years in foreign policy. What's your judgment of his first 2 years, and then his next 2 years, and then his year after that?
My judgment is pretty dismal. In fact, I wonder if the president today would say, you know, look at my 4.5, 5 years as president, and I am in the class with Lincoln and Roosevelt, because I think he has achieved almost nothing. In fact, I was recently in the Middle East, and I found once again that people talk about the receding American power, the diminishing American presence in the region, and that's not a debating point. That is, it's mentioned the way it's mentioned that Syria is having a civil war. It's just a fact of life one has to deal with. And, of course, for Arabs and Israelis who are somewhat tied to us, it's an unfortunate fact. I really think it's a very unsuccessful foreign policy unless, and this is really what I argue in that commentary article, unless the goal of the foreign policy is a reduction in American global power.
Now, I do come armed with a few quotations. Listen to the next one, and I won't immediately identify the author.
Okay.
"We shall listen, not lecture, learn, not threaten. We will enhance our safety by earning the respect of others and showing respect for them. In short, our foreign policy will rest on the traditional American values of restraint and empathy, not on military might." Who does that sound like?
You know, it could certainly be Obama. It could be George Bush in 2000 running for president. I really don't know.
Well, let me give you the little bit of surprise that I've saved up for you. It is Theodore Sorensen, who was sort of the intellectual grand vizier to John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
And his speechwriter. Does that reflect the Kennedy foreign policy approach?
I wouldn't have said so. I think Kennedy, of course, you know, it's a truncated administration, but I think he had a reasonably weak foreign policy. Of course, he had the Bay of Pigs. He had the disastrous meeting with Gustav in Geneva. And then Kennedy kind of knew it. That is, he seems to have had a little bit of an epiphany and wanted to have a tougher and stronger, including in military terms.
But here's my point. Sorensen was at his side and at his writing desk, so to speak, for Kennedy. Surely that statement I just gave, just read by Sorensen, is a kind of rhetoric that goes with presidents talking about foreign policy. There is a realpolitik very often behind the rhetoric, which is of a very different order. Is that possibly the case? You start this article with a number of boilerplate altruistic quotations from Obama, but is it possibly merely boilerplate and rhetoric, while there is a firmer and realpolitik kind of orientation towards our challenged position in the world?
Well, it's possible. I mean, I think a couple of things are possible. One, precisely what you're suggesting. Every president makes a certain number of rhetorical excursions, but then there's realpolitik. A second possibility is that a president changes his mind. Jimmy Carter said after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979 that he had, you know, changed his view of the Soviets. And I think Kennedy may have changed his view as well. So that's another possibility, that people actually grow in the job or change in the job. And the third possibility that one does have to consider is that at least sometimes they mean what they say, and that the speeches are actually a great insight into what the president thinks. Sorting that out is very, very hard and probably easier to do in retrospect.
The title of your new article, The Citizen of the World Presidency, is a real grabber as a title. And here, I guess, is where it comes from, or here is where it was first uttered by Obama. He's speaking in Berlin. He's still merely a candidate for the presidency. This is 2008, before the election. But he says, and you quote this in the article, "Tonight I speak to you not as a candidate for president, but as a citizen, a proud citizen of the United States and a fellow citizen of the world. The burdens of global citizenship continue to bind us together." That's rather heartening and thrilling in a way, isn't it?
Well, I probably disagree with you there.
Well,
Think of someone who had just won the crusade in Europe, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Yeah.
Hard to think of President Eisenhower speaking about global citizenship rather than American leadership.
Well, I say when I say it's heartening and thrilling, I am, of course, indulging in irony. I watched that speech when it was broadcast, and it struck me as one can only use this, and maybe even to a fellow tribesman, it struck me as ultimately chutzpahdik. This man wasn't yet president of the United States, but he announces that he is a citizen of the world, and they have nothing to fear from him and everything to hope for from his largesse.
You know, it's funny. The words you used, heartening and thrilling, that you used, ironically, of course, for most of the listeners of that speech, were an accurate description of their views. People were thrilled by this apparent new approach. There was even Chris Matthews, the TV talking head, who said, you know, the thrill went up his leg. So a lot of people were thrilled by that rhetoric.
Was the thrill up his leg in response to that particular speech, or just generally to his presence?
I think it was to the nomination, yeah.
The nomination itself, of course, yeah. You have a lot of quotes, and indeed, we have, going to another major and very important speech, about 4 or 5 months, is it, after his inauguration, he shows up in Cairo.
Yes.
And the Cairo speech is of tremendous interest. Tell us about it.
Well, this is a very strange thing. The president's just in office now. It's just a few months in office from January 20. And he goes to Cairo to speak to Muslims, to speak to the Islamic world, which is very interesting thing from several points of view. He might have gone to, say, Indonesia, the world's most populous Islamic country. Instead, he goes to the old Arab Middle East, which is one important, maybe wrong decision. He gives a speech in a dictatorship under President Mubarak, and he doesn't really say anything about the fact that Egypt is a dictatorship, so there's certainly a message there. And then it's interesting, he's not speaking to Egyptians, Saudis, Indonesians, Malaysians. He's speaking to Muslims as if their nationality didn't matter. He's speaking to them as a religious community. Now, that's a very odd thing, I think, for an American president to do, particularly if you're, you know, from a realpolitik point of view. Because what we have in common with these countries is a number of interests, but religion isn't one of them.
Let me quote from that speech as you offer some of the content in your article. He said there, "I have known Islam on three continents before coming to the region where it was first revealed. Then he says, as a boy, I spent several years in Indonesia and heard the call of the azan at the break of dawn and the fall of dusk. And then he goes on to say, I've come here to Cairo to seek a new beginning between the United States and Muslims around the world, one based on mutual interest and mutual respect. And I consider it part of my responsibility as President of the United States to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam wherever they appear.
Wow. I mean, think of that last sentence. That's the job of the President of the United States. That's a bizarre definition of the job of the President. And it's bizarre to think of the United States as being, as a country, as a nation state, as having relations with Muslims rather than with governments around the world. It's a very interesting and novel formulation, a bad one, I think.
I hope this isn't too gossipy or too irresponsible of me, but does it ever cross your mind that maybe some of his suspicious critics may be right when they suggest that for a while at least he was considered a Muslim as a boy in the Indonesian school?
Oh boy, you're going to get me into one of those controversies.
Not too much, no, not too far.
Well, it's certainly possible, I think. You know, when he was a kid, I mean, a kid who's, I forget how old he was, a child of that age doesn't get to choose a religion and may be considered to have the religion of a parent. So, you know, who knows? I mean, he has strongly defined himself as a believing Christian as an adult, anyway.
Yes, though, the kind of Christianity preached by the Reverend Wright at that church here in Chicago was rather of a different order. In fact, it was very much, and still is by the successor to Reverend Wright, it still is essentially a social Christianity high on the social gospel, which leans very heavily leftwards and indeed is very hostile essentially to capitalism.
Yes, yes. And wholly politicized, yeah.
And also hostile to Israel and very friendly to a neighboring divine, namely Minister Farrakhan, who's often honored in that church.
Yeah, yeah. I just think there's a real deep problem here. Our presidents are not supposed to be religious figures, you know. There are countries where the leader is a political and religious figure. Morocco, for example. The king is commander of the faithful, too. That's not America. And this whole business of, you know, he has a special responsibility to protect Islam. He has a special responsibility to speak to Muslims. I cannot remember a previous president who took that stance. And I don't think it has panned out for the United States. If you want to look at this completely non-ideologically, you know, what have we gained from this? I don't see we've gained anything.
I want to offer one last quotation from Obama as given by you in the new article and commentary, The Citizen of the World Presidency. I read now your words and then his words. Obama told the UN in his first address there, quote, "It is my deeply held belief that in the year 2009, more than at any point in human history, the interests of nations and peoples are shared." And then you say, presumably this was a reference to his preachment in Berlin in 2008. And you quote again from the 2008 speech, "This is the moment when we must come together to save this planet. Let us resolve that we will not leave our children a world where the oceans rise and famine spreads and terrible storms devastate our lands." That's, again, a noble sentiment shared with not merely Al Gore, but millions of other Americans, even some Republicans as well as Democrats.
A noble sentiment and a wholly unrealistic view of what a president does, can achieve and should be trying to achieve, I think.
So we come really now to the payoff question, which I've just been leading to this, and mm-hmm. I want to hear what you've got to say on this as you do and develop it in the article. Let us now examine Obama foreign policy in the many different sectors where it has been applied or where it has been found wanting and lacking and sort of absent. We can begin certainly with the Middle East, which is very much on the front burner these days in terms of our apprehension and concern, but much of the rest of the world, including China, including Russia, are also part of your analysis. What has he actually done or tried to do or failed to do in the foreign policy realm?
Well, I think first, he had a view that we could have a better relationship with a number of countries that were alienated, treated badly, bullied by the Bush administration. For example, Iran in the Middle East and Syria in the Middle East. And so he would reach out to them. The term was engagement. Okay, it's 4.5 years later, and look where we are. Iran is closer to a bomb. Our relations are no better. Syria is a complete mess and remains hostile to the United States. And we, as I speak to you, are probably on the verge of a military strike against Syria. So nothing gained there.
We are recording this, I should tell our listeners and downloaders, on August 30th, a Friday, where there still is no word from the White House as to whether we will or won't, but there was a statement by the president that he's thinking about it very seriously.
I think Obama made another huge error in the, well, a series of errors in the Middle East. You know, he wanted to talk to Muslims in that Cairo speech. That means he wasn't talking to citizens of Egypt, of Tunisia, of Saudi Arabia, just Muslims everywhere. The problem with that is that people do also define themselves as citizens of countries. There is such a thing as nationalism. So what message did he have to Egyptians, for example, who were living in a dictatorship, in a tyranny, with fixed elections and no freedom of speech or assembly? He had no message to them. He was palsy-walsy with Mubarak, whom Hillary Clinton said was a family friend. In June 2009, millions of Iranians rose up in protest, and in the critical 11 days after their protest, silence from the president.
That was a protest against a stolen election, apparently.
Yes, and he was interested in engaging. He talked about engagement, but he was interested in engaging with government. So the peoples of those countries and their problems disappeared, and he lost the sympathy that he had had. You remember opinion polls when he was elected president showed in lots of foreign countries he was hugely popular. Well, 4 years later, he's lost that popularity. The third mistake was the way he handled Israel. He seems genuinely to have believed that distancing the United States from Israel was a useful thing to do. It would give us more running room. It would make us more independent of Israeli foreign policy desires. And he obsessed over the question of construction in Israeli settlement. For 20 years, Israelis and Palestinians negotiated on and off regularly. For the entire first term of Obama, there were no negotiations. And that was his fault, because he took such a hard line on settlements that he made it impossible for the Palestinians to compromise. He took a far harder line than Yasser Arafat had ever taken. He had negotiated while there was construction and settlement. So I think if you look at the Middle East, Obama really has nothing to show for his first term, nothing positive.
You've been an important advisor on Middle East policy to two other presidents. Who really has helped to shape his views on those various countries and what to do about or with them, all the way from our Iran involvement down to the present policy or lack of certainty regarding Syria?
That is a very interesting question. I think not the cabinet. That is, I don't think Hillary Clinton shaped his views. I don't think that John Kerry or Chuck Hagel are shaping the president's views today. I think he came into office with a set of views, and on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, they seem to have been shaped by his old academic friend, Rashid Khalidi.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think he's learned anything new in these last 4 years. He has, you know, the staff, there's a tight staff in the White House. But as I look at that staff, there are people who are highly competent as staff members, but they're not strategists. And so I think a lot of this really is inside the president's head. I mean, I think foreign policy is really made by the president. This is really a top-down administration.
Henry Kissinger, as well as others, have said that one basic purpose of foreign policy for this country is the maximizing of American power. I couldn't resist suggesting that maybe now the policy is maximizing Samantha power.
Yeah. Well, you know, I argue in the article in commentary that it's actually attempting to minimize or reduce American power. Your reference to Samantha Power now is very interesting because, of course, she made a reputation in a book about the Balkans, criticizing our delay in intervening in the Balkans because of the loss of life. And, you know, she's associated with intervention, humanitarian intervention.
Exactly. Yeah.
I've often wondered how in hell she stayed in her job, frankly, with 100,000 people now dead and 4 million refugees and displaced persons in Syria, and the administration resolutely doing nothing. You know, a resignation on principle would certainly have been possible.
Well, she only came in about 5 or 6 months ago, but the Syria policy goes back for the last 2 or 3 years.
Yes, the Syria policy goes really back to, you're right, 2011, when the Arab Spring spreads to Syria, the rebellion begins, and the United States does nothing, literally nothing.
In fact, a basic question, if you had still been advising presidents, indeed if you had been there advising him, he might have been bold enough to bring a leading Republican consultant on foreign affairs in to sort of balance the team. What would you have said about how to handle the Arab Spring? And that goes back to the beginning in Tunisia. It goes back to Libya. It goes back to what's happened all over not all over the Middle East, but over many of the contested nations in the Middle East. What would you have told the president to do or not do?
I was part of a group of people who were telling the president to back away from Mubarak, and I was actually telling him that before the Arab Spring began. That is, it seemed to me that Mubarak's effort...
Telling him that in print or face-to-face?
In print.
Yeah.
I did talk to people in the White House, but not at that level, at lower levels, and told them, you know, Mubarak was trying to get his son, Gamal, to be in as his successor. It was not going to work. The people of Egypt were not going to buy a dynasty, and the army was not going to buy a dynasty. Now, that would have been good advice. That proved to be true. When Mubarak fell, I thought the president was right to back away from him. I do not share the view, which we associate with the Saudis and the Israelis, that he abandoned Mubarak. I mean, once you had millions of people in the streets saying Mubarak must go, I don't think there was any alternative but to back away from him. We certainly weren't going to advise him to have the army go out in the streets and kill people to put down a massive rebellion. So I think there I would not criticize the president, but I'd criticize him on a different ground. This administration's policy toward Mubarak was, well, he's there, so we're going to kiss up to him. We don't want to criticize. Then came the SCAF, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, which ruled Egypt for about a year, and we kissed up to them, despite their various abuses. Then came Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood, president for however long, a year, I guess.
About a year, yeah.
And we kissed up to him. And his human rights abuses and failures we were silent on. And I hope we're not going to repeat that now that the army is back. It seems to me a policy of basically kissing up to who is ever in power is a mistake, is an unprincipled policy the United States should not pursue. I have actually been writing that and in the occasional meetings with White House officials. I had one, 4 weeks ago, I guess. That's the advice I've been giving, that things are moving too fast. You know, I can't predict, I don't think anybody can, where Egypt will be a year from now. So if you can't predict it and you also can't affect it much because our influence is quite limited, it seems to me the smarter thing to do is just stand on principle. Just say, look, we're Americans, we believe in the following things, freedom of speech, freedom of press, independent judicial system, the right to protest peacefully, and we're going to criticize you if you do things like put newspaper editors in jail and shoot down unarmed protesters. I think that's a safer position in the long run than making believe we're in love with whoever is in power this year.
Towards the end of this most interesting article in the current issue of Commentary, you kind of venture over into my territory. I am now a emeritized professor of psychology, and you do some speculation on the inner psychology of Barack Obama and what he, how the presidency has affected him, and the burdens that maybe the presidency has imposed upon him. Why don't you speak to that without my leading you any further?
Well, now in the presence of a genuine psychologist, I'm...
Well, a mere social psychologist, so you're...
I wonder, as I look at Obama, for one thing, why he is not learning from his mistakes. And I see no evidence that he is. There's no epiphany. There is no... When as president has he ever said, I got that wrong. I'm changing my view. I'm changing our policy. Never, as far as I can recall. So one of the things that makes me wonder is, despite the fact that I see his foreign policy as a great failure, maybe he doesn't. Maybe he sees it as a success because he had a goal that was not clear to me, which was to change the direction of American foreign policy almost since World War II, to be the superpower, to be the most powerful country in the world, to be the one that, frankly, intervenes the most around the world, that has this gigantic military machine and uses it. That's been an American pattern for generations. And we need to break those habits. That's a term he used in that Berlin speech you mentioned. Break the habits of, if you want to use negative terms, of domination, of hegemony, of interventionism. I would rather use leadership of the free world. It's a speculation. I really do wonder what goes on in his head.
Well, let me suggest one thing that does go on in this, in the realm of practical politics, maybe even as other figures who close to him advise him. And it's simply this. The nation is rather war-weary. And it's war-weary not only because of the deaths of American soldiers. It's war-weary because of the tremendous economic exactions that our military policy has required of us, by golly, since Korea, virtually. That is, since, I'm talking about the period after World War II. And even as he pulls back and says we're going to be essentially far less active in the world, we'll go through the motions, and we have to kind of depend upon some of our allies to join us in some of these things. But it's a bit of a charade. Basically, we can't accomplish very much without tremendous cost, not merely cost in dollars, but cost in alienating the American public. And that being the case, and elections always being on the mind of party officials, including presidents, maybe that's the ultimate basis for this policy of benign withdrawal, which he has been practicing with regard to most of the trouble in the world.
Well, your description of American public opinion, I think, is accurate. After so much money, so many years, so many American soldiers killed or wounded, nobody.
We've even got Republicans talking that way. A presidential aspirant, Ron Paul, is essentially saying the very same thing.
That's right, and I, I think that's terrible, and I think we would pay a very heavy price for pursuing such a policy. But you see it on Syria. It's interesting. Look, the opinion polls are against, most Americans are against any engagement in Syria. I've testified in the House Armed Services Committee in July on this question, and members on both sides of the aisle, very, very leery, reluctant, unwilling. And it struck me. I understand that for the reasons that you stated. But that could change with real presidential leadership. And I'm struck. You know, Secretary of State Kerry gave two speeches in the last week about Syria. Actually, from my point of view, quite good speeches. Where is the president? You know, if we want, this is what happened in England when, leading to their vote of no. Where is the leadership in this country of a president explaining to the American people, and not one in one 20-minute speech, but over a period of weeks, why we need to exercise leadership? why we may need to do something about this use of chemical weapons. It is striking to me, you know, the president is sort of leaning on the public weariness, but the public weariness can be diminished, and the public willingness to be involved can rise if the president explains, this is not another Iraq. I'm not sending soldiers. You know, if you go back to the whole summer, you had a series of statements by the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dempsey, explaining how we can't do anything, it's impossible, it's hopeless, it would take the whole Air Force. And these were striking statements because had the White House once said, you know what, General, you don't make foreign policy, shut up. That would have been the end of Dempsey's speeches. But he went on and on and on. So clearly, for a long time, the White House thought, that's a fine thing to be hearing, for the American people to be hearing.
Well, are you suggesting really that Obama approved of what Dempsey was saying, or that he put him up to say it?
I don't know if he put – I would not say he put him up to it. I think he approved. And I think someone like Dempsey, you know, has a sense of what the White House wants to be hearing. Then something happened that they didn't expect. Assad broke the rules, and he made the president look like a jerk because of that red line speech. And all of a sudden, the White House was saying, oh, man, now what? They painted themselves into a corner.
Yeah.
And I do sympathize with the critics who have said in the last few weeks that it's one thing to strike Syria because we have national security interests there, which I do believe. It's another thing to strike Syria because the president mistakenly used the term red line.
We're on the cusp or the edge of action with regard to Syria. Again, I make clear to those who are downloading and listening that we're recording this on August 30th. The president earlier today said, I'm still thinking. Rather reminds you of Jack Benny, your money or your life. And Benny's famous response was, I'm thinking. But something will happen. I assume he won't back away completely. He can't, having gone this far. What do you take to be the risks or the possible advantages of the pinprick assaults that we might throw at them with missiles from the offshore warships? Or might we, in fact, be drawn in deeper, maybe even ultimately to boots on the ground?
Well, I don't think so. You know, I guess there's one advantage to doing a pinprick, which I would define as doing a very small number of cruise missiles and leaving it at that. The advantage is that the less you do, the less likely it is that there will be any reaction from Assad or anyone else, Hezbollah or Iran. But you pay a very heavy price for that. You're not really punishing or deterring if you don't actually hurt Assad's war machine. I mean, that's what he cares about. He's engaged in a civil war here. So neither he nor anyone else will be impressed that it is overly risky to use chemical weapons unless we actually do inflict real damage on him. I do not believe that he will respond in any way. I was in the Bush administration in 2007 when the Israelis bombed the nuclear reactor the Syrians were building with North Korean help, and the Israelis predicted that Assad would do nothing in reply. And most of us in the White House thought, gee, that's nothing? Really? Nothing? That was literally correct. Nothing.
Yeah.
He, in fact, bulldozed the site, trying to make believe there had never been a reactor there. What is Assad going to do? I mean, he has no way of really striking back against the U.S. Others do, that is, Hezbollah and Iran.
Well, what's very interesting to me is that what's coming from the Arab world, it's coming, I think, from Syria and indeed also from Iran, is a threat. If you attack Syria, we're going to attack Israel.
I don't believe it. And the reason I don't believe it is that, again, Assad is engaged in a civil war, and it's a very difficult fight for him. I imagine that he wouldn't have used chemical weapons unless he felt he needed to. For him to attack Israel is near suicidal because they will attack back. And that will hurt his chances in this civil war. It just doesn't make sense for him to do it.
Is it conceivable to you that Iran might throw some missiles? Of course, they're not yet nuclear armed, but still they can do a lot of damage on a small nation.
No,
that Iran might attack.
It really isn't. I mean, it'd be proved wrong in short order, but it isn't. Israel will not have attacked Iran. America will have attacked Syria. So for Iran to respond by attacking Israel would be, I think, bizarre. And the Iranians, of course, then run the risk that the Israelis would say, huh, attacked by Iranian missiles, let's go. This is our chance. This is our moment to attack the Iranian nuclear program. So I think they would risk that. The larger risk is Hezbollah, but there again, Hezbollah's purpose is to deter Israel from striking Iran and its nuclear program. I don't think they're going to waste that asset on this Syrian civil war.
The Middle East is a constant preoccupation, and it has preoccupied me in this conversation. And, of course, it preoccupies you to some degree. Yep. Your article in commentary focuses a good deal on the Middle East, but also it addresses other areas of the world which require American foreign policy decision or decisiveness, most particularly Russia and China. And you see that we have failed essentially in those connections as well.
You remember the president started out with this reset with Russia. The word actually came from Hillary Clinton. Complete failure. Our relations with Russia are as bad as really they have ever been since the fall of the Soviet Union. There's no cooperation. There's a very sour relationship between the two countries. So we've gained absolutely nothing there.
Putin, well, now, is there something we should have done but didn't do? Or
I think there is.
Something we did that we shouldn't have done?
I think we have been largely silent on Putin's re-Stalinization.
Uh-huh.
He has brought them back to Soviet days when it comes to freedom, human rights. Mm-hmm. And there would have been no way for us to prevent that, but we could have been honest about it. We could have spoken up about it loudly in the way that Reagan spoke up about the evil empire. And the president has really not been willing to do that, which I think is morally a shame. And what would the price have been for doing it? Nothing. I mean, he may have thought that by being silent, he'd get some kind of break from Putin. He's got nothing from Putin. I would say the same thing, by the way, about China, where Hillary Clinton was notoriously quiet about the human rights abuses there. Again, with the thought, I suppose, that we're going to do business with the Chinese. Well, you know, we haven't really done much business with the Chinese. They're engaged in a massive military buildup that has terrified all of their neighbors, including the communist neighbors, like Vietnam and Laos, I mean, which are like Japan, Australia, South Korea, Singapore, hoping that the United States will remain a very strong force in
Asia. Their Kissinger equivalent is telling them China's policy must be to maximize Chinese power.
Yes. And the question that Asians have about us is the question that Arabs have about us. Are we going to stick it out, or are we fading? The administration has talked usefully about the pivot to Asia, but there really isn't much of a pivot to Asia.
Well, that's part of one of the handicaps that having a democratic electorate tends to impose upon policymakers, isn't it?
Yes. We saw this in England with the vote against Prime Minister Cameron on Syria. You can overcome it to a reasonable degree by leadership. The example I give you is Vietnam. I mean, at the end of the Vietnam War, it was common to say that the United States would take a generation or two to recover before we were willing to be a world power again. And then, 1980 comes Reagan, and he's willing to be world power again and to bring the country along with him. It is possible.
We're close to the evaporation or the end of the available time, but I want to try something on you. I want to offer you two quotations and get your response. One is Pope Paul VI speaking at the United Nations and ending his speech, which he delivered in French, with the words, jamais la guerre, jamais plus la guerre, never again war, never war. And I offer you also some lines from Tennyson's poem Locksley Hall, where we're told that they look forward to the time when, this is memory, when the battle flags are furled, when the war drum throbs no longer, and the battle flags are furled, in the parliament of man, the federation of the world. Kind-hearted people aspiring to human perfection and to the perfection of social systems still visualize the possibility that ultimately we may put an end to the scourge of war and to the nastiness that often develops between states. Maybe the way to achieve that is for states to fade away. I know that that isn't your business, and that's pretty fanciful and far-fetched, but is it conceivable that somehow, given human nature and given human social systems, that we might grow beyond the sort of realpolitik that we have to practice now, in which finally the ultimate threat or meaning is the possibility of recourse to arms?
I think progress in that direction is possible, in the sense that, you know, we had two world wars in the previous century, but since 1945 there hasn't been one, and there's every reason to hope that there is never that kind of cataclysm again. But the realist in me would say there is still evil in the world. And just as we need policemen to protect us from evildoers in our own societies, there needs to be some world order and some way of preventing acts of evil, for example, the use of chemical warfare, poison gas in Syria, acts of aggression, acts of international crime, war crimes. And we still live in a world where those things have to exist and have to be dealt with, and since we are the leading power in the world, I think this comes up our street.
So let's stop dreaming about universal peace. Let's, in essence, keep our powder, trust in God and keep our powder dry.
I think you can continue to dream, but keep your powder dry.
Thank you so much for joining us
today. Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Elliot Abrams has been our guest, and that new article of his to be found in Commentary is titled The Citizen of the World Presidency. And with that, we'll close down. But thanks again, Elliot, for joining us.
You're welcome.